Welcome back to the Cambridge 5 podcast. I'm your host, Slaney Chadwick-Ross, and this is episode 2, Intelligence and Institutions Through the First World War. Initially, this episode was to take us from pre-World War I to the 1930s, but instead we're just going to go through World War I because there's so much to cover. And we're mainly going to talk about the institutions that would eventually become what we know today as MI5 and MI6. The history of spying is also a history of bureaucracy, so we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about institutions. The organizations that form the backbone of those in play in this story were formed at the beginning of the 20th century, but there had certainly been intelligence services in Great Britain well before this. You can trace them back at least as far as the Renaissance. We'll also be talking today about how various personalities influenced or hindered the development of the intelligence services bureaucracy. Our history of the Cambridge Five is also a history of personality, and it continually surprises me just how much individual personalities factor into the life of these seemingly impersonal intelligence agencies. Before we dive in, I have a note about my sourcing. I have posted a full bibliography on our website, cambridge5podcast.com. My main sources for this episode are two books by Christopher Andrew, Defend the Realm, A History of MI5, and his latest book, The Secret World. Christopher Andrew is a retired history professor at Cambridge University and the official historian of MI5. I'm also using R.J. Aldrich and Rory Cormack's book on prime ministers and intelligence services. That's called The Black Door. I'm using Richard Davenport Hines's book, Enemies Within, and John Hughes Wilson's book, The Secret State. My new friend Deborah Bauer recommended a wonderful book, Tammy Proctor's Female Intelligence, Women and Espionage in the First World War. And I'll also be referring to spy novels by William Le Queux and John Buchan and Agatha Christie. All of these are easily accessible through bookstores and libraries. You don't need academic library access to read them. And I'm going to refer also to some texts from academic presses that are a little harder to get, and a lot of these are grounded in my own field. I also did some primary source gathering through the UK's National Archives online. I have a set also of citation practices. In my script, I follow MLA in-text citation, so I have page numbers or Kindle locations for everything I'm telling you. I'm not going to include these citations in the recording, but it's important to me that you know that they're there. If I ever quote directly from another text, I will let you know that I'm doing that, and I'll let you know what the source is. I'm telling you all this because I'm so conscious of how much information I'm leaving out here for the sake of time and for the sake of moving forward to our story of the Cambridge Five. Even though today's script is almost the length of a dissertation chapter. So I want to be really careful about my citation practices just for my own academic integrity, and because it really bothers me when people put things out without appropriately acknowledging where their information comes from. So, with that said, let's dive in. Intelligence gathering in the early 20th century, and before that too, of course, relied on two types of activities that we need to define: signals intelligence and human intelligence. They're often shortened. You'll see them written as SIGINT or HUMINT. Signals intelligence is the collection, decryption, and interpretation of communications. And in our period, this involved both machine technology, such as radio and wireless, and human brain work. It also involved systems organization and code breaking. So we're talking about both the technical matter of collecting data and the work of decoding that data. I looked on the CIA's website for their definition of human intelligence, and it's very straightforward. This is a quote: information acquired by human sources through clandestine collection. But for now, I want to set the stage for talking about intelligence agencies at the beginning of the 20th century. And to do that, we really need to think about who was in charge of things at the end of the 19th century and moving into the 20th. And a really good source, if you want to know about this, is David Cannadine's Decline and Fall of the British Aristocracy. It covers the late 19th through the mid-20th century, and it gives us some idea of what was happening in this very rarefied demographic that held almost all political power, land, and social capital. But in this period, late 19th, early 20th century, because of changing laws and changing demographics, we witness a transition from a situation where a very small group of landed elite was basically synonymous with the power of the state to a very different, although by no means egalitarian, social and political landscape. And this was happening across Europe for several reasons. Among them was a drastic plunge in agricultural prices that undermined real estate as a source of wealth. So for the longest time, land had been a continual, steady source of wealth that ensured long-term prosperity for individual families. And this changed during this period. And wealthy people from outside the ruling classes had to some extent been able to buy their way into this system, and this was happening with increasing frequency and was of course resented by incumbents who displayed their prejudices against outsiders in pretty much the ways you might expect. Barbara Tuchman, in her book, The Proud Tower, A Portrait of the World Before World War I, quotes an aristocrat. He's talking about wealthy Jewish interlopers and how they were particularly begrudged any rise in social status. And he said, quote, "Not because we disliked them individually, for some of them were charming and even brilliant, but because they had brains and understood finance." Legislation also changed the formation of the ruling classes. We have the Third Reform Act of 1884. This is also called the Representation of the People Act. And this changed the voting requirements, and in doing so, increased the size of the electorate. It wasn't universal suffrage. There were still property requirements for men until the Fourth Reform Act of 1918, and for women until 1929. But it did change the balance of power. So the voting population in the UK in 1883, which did include Ireland at this point, was 3 million. And with the passage of the Third Reform Act, it was now 6 million. So you've just doubled the amount of people who are able to vote. Rich people were still usually the only people who could afford to run for office, because it was incumbent on candidates and elected officials to fund their own campaigns and constituencies. But the introduction of death duties and an increase in income taxes in 1894 also changed who was rich. So I'm talking about this not because this podcast is a history of the British class system or economy, but because these are major, major social changes, and they determine who's going to have a voice in government and in administration and policy. And they also determine how people feel about themselves as members of their society and of their nation. I think a lot of people kind of cling to ideas about the pre-World War I moment as a sort of genteel and Gentile utopia, when it was really a hugely turbulent period that gave rise to all these changes. It was not a fixed society at all. According to Barbara Tuchman, and I'm quoting her here, "As a nation, Britain in 1895 had an air of careless supremacy which galled her neighbors. The attitude, called splendid isolation, was both a state of mind and a fact. Britain didn't worry seriously about potential enemies, felt no need of allies, and had no friends." This is a pretty convenient stance, it seems like, for a colonial power to take. We didn't need friends. Of course, this was before the outbreak of the Boer War in South Africa and the Venezuelan crisis of 1895. So in reality, splendid isolation was a cover for a wide scope of secret intelligence operations. And the Victorian period was characterized by a lot of intelligence gathering in the British colonies. According to Richard Davenport Hines, and I'm quoting him here, the London government's success during Victoria's reign in protecting its ideals of progress, prosperity, and peace was achievable only by investigating, watching, and listening to hostile powers and by collating, interpreting, and acting on intelligence about potential foes. And here, Davenport Hines is drawing from William Beaver's excellent book, Under Every Leaf, How Britain Played the Greater Game from Afghanistan to Africa, which is a really comprehensive look at how 19th century colonial institutions were responsible for developing early intelligence practices. And the government agency that led this effort was the Topographical and Statistical Department, founded in 1855, which morphed into the Intelligence Department, or ID, in 1873. So from the name Topographical and Statistical, you can probably guess that a lot of what they did involved mapping and data collection. So it's very crucial to remember that British intelligence agencies were formed by colonial contact, especially with India and Ireland. The intelligence department operated out of Queen Anne's Gate in Westminster and collected and filed information from foreign newspapers and periodicals. So this is a form of signals intelligence gathering. None of the information was collected illicitly, so it was not officially secret, which is why it would be referred to later as open source intelligence, or OSINT. Because the work itself was not illegal, it could be carried out by foreign office attachés posted to various embassies abroad, although it was partly out of concern that military attachés not appear to be spying that separate intelligence agencies were founded in 1909. Ultimately, the department built up a very sophisticated database of information that allowed them to keep tabs on world events and world opinion. Davenport Hines notes that when the Dewey Decimal System was introduced in 1876, the Intelligence Division adopted it for their own files, and their classifications reached as many as 7 decimal points. That is a pretty intense level of detail in their filing system. And this is not going to be the last time that you hear about the importance of a strong filing and cataloging system to intelligence gathering. I think this is why a lot of people focus on the 19th century as a formative period for British intelligence services. There is a sense of something that we think of as the British Empire that exists in the Victorian period and then gradually falls apart through the 20th century, through the 21st century. You could argue that we're witnessing this now. But we have to remember that institutions without support, funding, and leadership tend to flounder, and that happened also around the turn of the 20th century. If you are an empire feeling pretty good about your continued empireship, you might tend to get a little lax in the security department at home. And perhaps that's where Tuchman's idea of splendid isolation comes in. Perhaps there is an overconfidence there. Or it could be more complicated than that. Davenport Hines sees this intense intelligence gathering work in the late Victorian period, which you may have heard called the Great Game, as something characteristic of an empire in decline. He sees it as a paranoid, unstable activity, the activity of an empire that's waiting for the other shoe to drop. And it did, most obviously, in the form of World War I. And this just makes me think of Linda Cawley's book, Britons, in which Cawley talks about the formation of British identity and British patriotism in the 18th century. In this context, she says, and I'm quoting her here, Britishness was superimposed over an array of internal differences in response to contact with the other, and above all, in response to conflict with the other. This also applies to how people who were involved in mapping and data gathering on behalf of the British Empire were themselves part of forming our modern ideas about what a British spy and British spying looks like. Despite these formative beginnings, Britain entered the 20th century with less of an intelligence infrastructure than it had in the 19th. In his book, The Secret World, Christopher Andrew observes that there was very little continuity between 19th and 20th century intelligence services, and this is especially true regarding cryptography, a key element in signals intelligence. The deciphering branch had actually been shuttered in 1844 amid public outrage when it was revealed that the government had been reading people's mail. This also has to do, I think, with how countries tend to split their spy agencies into those that work outside the country and those that work inside it. Today, we're talking about the formation of MI5, which is domestic security, and MI6, which is foreign intelligence. In the United States, the FBI and CIA ostensibly play the same roles. And historically, there is tension between the two over jurisdictions and over questions of how the civil rights of citizens differ from those who aren't. Intelligence agencies really live in these kind of contradictory spaces. Despite the dearth of a comprehensive intelligence service at the national level, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were some existing surveillance structures within Great Britain, and one of them was the Metropolitan Police Special Branch, which had been founded in 1883 specifically to counter Irish Republican activism. Part of its mandate was to gather information on private citizens who might be involved in these activities. And John Hughes Wilson talks about this in his book, The Secret State. In the late 19th century, terrorist incidents in London, coupled with new political demands for home rule from the Irish state, culminated in the murder of the Chief Secretary for Ireland, Lord Frederick Cavendish, in Dublin in 1882. And this was the galvanizing incident for the formation of the Met Special Branch. And then we have MO2 and MO3, which were founded in 1903, and they were founded for the purposes of foreign intelligence and counterintelligence investigations. They were under the purview of the Directorate of Military Operations within the War Office. A former head of the Met Special Branch named William Melville headed up investigations for MO2 and MO3 after officially retiring from the Met in 1903. And Melville was uniquely qualified for this role because of his work in providing security services for members of the British royal family and visiting heads of state during this very tumultuous period in European and American history, wherein several world leaders were victims of assassinations and assassination attempts. And Melville also knew Gustav Steinhauer. Steinhauer had been trained by the Pinkerton Agency in Chicago, which is a forerunner of the modern Secret Service, and he headed Section N, the German Admiralty's new intelligence service, which was founded in 1901. Besides keeping an eye on Steinhauer, Melville also kept tabs on the storied Russian intelligence agency, the Okhrana, which operated under the auspices of Tsar Nicholas II. And now the head of the Okhrana was a man named Peter Rakovsky. And Rakovsky lived in grand style. He kept a suite of rooms for himself at the Savoy Hotel. According to Christopher Andrew, and I'm quoting him here, Melville was probably aware that Rakovsky and other Russian foreign intelligence officers were responsible for a series of explosions and agent provocateur operations on the continent designed to discredit Russian revolutionary emigres. He is unlikely to have known, however, that Rakovsky was probably also responsible for the fabrication of the infamous anti-Semitic forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which purports to describe a Jewish plot for world domination. So Melville was a pretty connected guy, and he was used to keeping tabs on all sorts of unsavory characters. In 1909, the Secret Intelligence Services expanded further with the formation of the Indian Political Intelligence Office, the IPIO, and the Secret Service Bureau. The IPIO was created in response to fears of Indian nationalism abroad, while the Bureau was formed on the recommendation of the Committee of Imperial Defense. Their rationale for doing so was that they believed, and I'm quoting them here, that an extensive system of German espionage exists in this country, and that we have no organization for keeping in touch with that espionage and for accurately determining its extent or objectives. Before MO3 became MI5, it went through another iteration as MO5 in 1907. And here it was headed by Major James Edmonds, a veteran of the War Office Intelligence Division who had served for 3 years in South Africa during the Boer War. As head of MO5, Edmonds had the twin goal of getting himself elected as an MP, which he succeeded in, and of tracking down what was then widely perceived by both the government and the public to be a national emergency, an infestation of German spies. Because of his experience at the War Office, Edmund had been aware of the existence of Section N early on. However, he and others at MO5 wrongly believed that Germany had developed a much more extensive espionage network within Great Britain than they actually had. But we can't talk about Edmonds without talking about his relationship with William Le Queux's spy novels. So this is a good moment for a spy novel sidebar. And the history of intelligence services is also the history of fiction about intelligence services. And sometimes the fiction precedes the fact. Christopher Andrew says that spy fiction is, quote, one of the few creative arts in which Britain became the world leader for the next century, which is kind of a great burn. A central conceit of Edwardian spy novels of the early 20th century is that a character who you thought you could trust above all others, who seems on the surface to be the representative and embodiment of the establishment and of patriotism and of empire, is actually the one you should fear the most, and he's capable of extraordinary disguise and of passing unnoticed in most situations. And one example that comes immediately to my mind is Agatha Christie's The Secret Adversary, which was published in 1922 but set in 1915 after the sinking of the Lusitania by German U-boats. The belief within the nascent intelligence community in Great Britain leading up to World War I was that German intelligence services had a secret fifth column of spies living in the UK and ready to be activated at any moment. This was largely the product of a spy novelist's mind, and this spy novelist was believed by the intelligence community to have access to this information. His name was William Le Queux. This is how he's described in The Black Door. And this is a long quote, but I think it's worth quoting in full because it's just so full of information. William Le Queux posed as an international espionage expert, but was in fact nothing of the sort. Instead, he was a tireless and well-paid pulp fiction writer who produced 5 novels a year until his death in 1927. The invasion of 1910 sold more than 1 million copies, and publicists at the Daily Mail, which possessed serialization rights, sent columns of men marching up Oxford Street dressed in Prussian uniforms, complete with blood-stained gloves, carrying sandwich boards that advertised the book. An inevitable flood of literary emulators hit the presses as Le Queux's royalties rolled in. Not to be outdone, Le Queux responded in 1909 with Spies of the Kaiser, which insisted that no fewer than 5,000 German undercover operatives were at work in Britain. This was a new idea. A whole undercover army, not just a few spies and saboteurs, were apparently biding their time until the Fatherland told them to retrieve their weapons from a series of arms dumps in the British countryside. And our friend Evans was totally into this. So reality and fiction are literally blurred here. And just as an aside for anyone who's interested in more about early 20th century spy novels, John Buchan and Erskine Childers were also prominent spy writers in this period. And Buchan's Green Mantle, to my mind, has a lot more cultural staying power than any of Le Queux's work. Green Mantle is wild and weird. It's about the Germans trying to instigate a Muslim uprising in the Middle East that will undermine British colonial power there. The 39 Steps is probably a little more famous because it's more of a conventional spy story and because Alfred Hitchcock made a film out of it and Orson Welles did a radio play, which I found a link to some audio for this on YouTube, and I will add that to the website. To return to our institutional history, as I've noted, MO3 would eventually become MI5. But it went through another iteration when the Secret Service Bureau was founded in 1909. And the Bureau was led by 2 people. We have a naval officer named Mansfield Cumming and an army officer named Vernon Kell. Kell would be head of MI5 until 1940, when he was fired by Winston Churchill. The Secret Service Bureau was initially housed in a small office at 64 Victoria Street in London. I Googled it. It's now a modern office tower. You can rent space there if you're so inclined. However, organizational and interpersonal friction led to the decision to split the Secret Service Bureau into two agencies, one of which would focus on intelligence operations within Britain and the other which would operate outside it. These were the two agencies that would eventually become MI5, headed by Kell, and SIS, which would become M11C, and then MI6, and was headed by Cumming. Mansfield Cumming had a habit of wearing a gold monocle. He personally went on intelligence gathering missions disguised in a mustache and a toupee. He had a good time. He called it capital sport. And another fun Cumming fact is that the chief of MI6 is still known as C, in reference to his first initial, and he only signed his name in green ink. So if you're looking for ways to be a lovable eccentric in your own workplace, there's some ideas for you. Vernon Kell, who had worked alongside Edmonds at MO5, also worked with Melville to investigate reports of German espionage throughout the country in the years leading up to World War I. And while we know that spy mania was overblown, that doesn't mean that there was absolutely nothing happening. Here's what Stella Rimington, the first female head of MI5 and also the author of several very, very good spy novels herself, says in her autobiography. She says, "Newspapers were full of reports of German agents going around the country, measuring the bridges, inspecting railway tunnels, and even counting the cows in the fields. Though this sounds hysterical, it was not quite as exaggerated as it may appear. There were certainly German efforts to penetrate Great Britain, but they were mainly naval. Although they were understaffed and underfunded, and thus depended upon help from local law enforcement throughout the country, Kell and the Bureau had a very important ally in the Home Secretary, Winston Churchill. Churchill loved Secret Services. Loved them sometimes too much. And one way that he helped out when he was Home Secretary was by making it easier for Kell to open people's mail without applying for a warrant from his office in the case of each individual letter. In doing so, he overrode the post office itself. And as I've alluded to, there are many privacy laws on the books in Great Britain and the USA that have long storied histories, and this is one of them. It's a really big deal to people when they find out that someone has been reading their mail. So this is a hot spot in our history. Intercepting correspondence, however, proved fruitful in several cases for these fledgling intelligence services. And there's a case I think it's funny, and I'm going to read to you an excerpt about it from Defend the Realm, Christopher Andrews' History of MI5. I'm quoting in full here again because I think Andrews tells this really well. It's just very funny. The case is that of Dr. Max Schultz, the first doctor of philosophy ever to be jailed for espionage in Britain. Despite convictions in Germany for embezzlement, he was used by N to gather intelligence on the Royal Navy at Portsmouth. The flamboyant Schultz had little notion of undercover operations, setting himself up on a houseboat in Portsmouth, flying the German flag from the stern, and throwing parties at which he attempted unsuccessfully to turn the conversation to naval matters. Though he quickly aroused suspicion, he acquired no useful information. On one occasion, while engaged in gun practice, he shot his housekeeper, Miss Sturgeon, in the arm. The proceedings during Schultz's trial were at times a match for his own personal eccentricity. He was tried in the name Dr. Phil Max Schultz, the authorities failing to realize that Phil, on statements signed by Schultz, referred not to a given name, but to his doctorate of philosophy. A combination of intercepted correspondence and human intelligence also brought down a spy named George Parrott, who was in the Royal Navy and fed information to Steinhauer, Section N. Melville followed him and saw him pass information to a man he described as having, quote, typical German walk and style. Parrott fell in with a German named Karl Henschel, who had moved to Britain in 1908 and was working undercover as a language teacher, married to an English wife. He made friends with Parrott, and the trio soon became a love triangle. Parrott passed classified naval intelligence to Henschel until the love triangle fractured in 1911. Parrott was arrested and dismissed from the Royal Navy, but his situation wasn't made public, nor was he tried. And there's a pattern here of not revealing the identity of spies for a couple of reasons. Concern about the public revelation of intelligence gathering methods, in this case, not wanting to reveal that the government was intercepting mail, and concern about public morale, if we are already dealing with a spy mania. In this case, the lack of initial consequences was probably an encouragement to George Parrott, who kept on going until prosecutors actually did have enough evidence to prosecute him without revealing their methods, and he was sentenced to 4 years of hard labor. Henschel was later granted immunity from prosecution and returned for flipping on German intelligence. He was paid off and went on his merry way, and then later on showed up at the police station loudly demanding to be arrested as a spy, which was a bit embarrassing for the service. And again, since this is a history of bureaucracy, it's important to note that the necessity to process so much mail led Kell to create a complicated filing and cross-referencing system that yielded results. Ultimately, he was able to read most of Steinhauer's uncoded correspondence with his agents, although Steinhauer himself managed to evade capture. Intercepting correspondence enabled Kell and MI5 to arrest 22 German spies the day that World War I was declared. So at the start of the war, Germany essentially had no one in Great Britain who could report on what the British expeditionary forces were doing. But it's worth lingering here to acknowledge that there was certainly a lack of real evidence. A lot of the early reports looked like wild goose chases. For example, in the summer of 1910, Kell investigated a report of two Germans, quote, signaling to each other by lamps at night along a railway line in Kent. And it turned out that this was just people camping. And here's an even stranger example from Kell's report for MI5 on German espionage activities in 1909, which I pulled from the National Archives and I'm quoting from here. In the first case, a German who gave the name of Corinna took a farm in the neighborhood of Frant in Sussex. Here he went in ostensibly for poultry farming, but it was noticeable that the farm at Bartley Mill was a great rendezvous for Germans, most of whom seemed to spend the greater part of the time in cycling and motoring all over the country. De Corinna himself was a typical German, and it was quite obvious that he could not be making his living from the proceeds of the farm. Although nothing was ever discovered which could definitely connect this man with espionage, the whole circumstances of the case were very peculiar and suspicious, and the extremely secluded position chosen from the scene of their operations, as well as the difficulty of watching it, lends color to the belief that it was used as a center for espionage. Like, what? So when the Aliens Subcommittee of the Committee of Imperial Defense, again, we're talking about bureaucracies here, decided to start its own registration system of foreigners living in Great Britain, it chose to keep this secret from the public. And we should note that Germany had a similar system of compulsory registration and restriction on movement of foreigners. The registration system in Britain was to be the purview of local law enforcement officials around the country, and the idea was that Kell and Melville would investigate reports of suspicious behavior. The British Alien Registry was an early triumph of data management, employing a new technology from the Roneo Company, founded in 1909. And the Roneo Company, from what I can tell now, manufactures and sells furniture. And this is according to Bloomberg.com. But back then, it was basically a system of index cards, which could be color-coded and cross-referenced, a researcher's dream. Different symbols were imprinted on the cards to indicate the threat level of a particular alien resident. If you received a red seal, you were considered high risk. From Christopher Andrews' description in Defend the Realm, quote, if in addition to the red seal, the card was marked with an X, the alien was to be searched on the outbreak of war. If with two crosses, he was on a wartime arrest list sent to chief constables. There are a few important legal aspects of this period that define the institutional role of intelligence in the 20th century, in 20th century Great Britain. One was the new Official Secrets Bill of 1911, and this bill modified the 1899 Official Secrets Act, which required the state to prove intent when prosecuting spies. The new act, which some Labour MPs thought seriously overstepped, but which nevertheless passed in Parliament, did not require the state to prove intent. basically, you could be prosecuted as a spy for being somewhere suspicious or looking suspicious, and the onus was on you to prove that you didn't have intent to pass information to the enemy. Following this change in the law, there were some high-profile public prosecutions of German spies. So even if the security services weren't finding secretly entrenched German armies around every corner, they themselves were gaining public approbation and awareness. In terms of counterintelligence, under the purview of Cumming and SIS, the British did have some sources reporting on German naval armament. Britannia was used to ruling the waves, but the big game changer technologically was the new battleship class Dreadnought, which, according to Christopher Andrew, quote, threatened to make all other battleships obsolete. The advent of World War I sped up all sorts of technologies that assisted in signals intelligence gathering, particularly aerial reconnaissance and naval intelligence. The British cut Germany's overseas telecables at the outset of the war, which meant that Germany had to rely on radio messages or foreign telecables, both of which could be intercepted. And the necessity of deciphering this traffic led the British to rebuild their code-breaking skills. There's a source that was footnoted in Christopher Andrew's book, Defend the Realm, which is a history of MI5, and I went ahead and pulled the record from the UK's National Archives, and I took a look. I'll go ahead and post some clips on the website so you can see this marvelous old document. It's very cool. It's dated 1921 and titled G Branch Report, The Investigation of Espionage. And there's a section in the preface that stood out to me, a description of the qualities that make a good investigator. Quote, the qualities required of the investigator are mental alertness, elasticity, knowledge of men, intuition, an accurate and powerful memory combined with imagination, judgment to choose the right method of handling a case and the moment to strike. His attainments should include, besides the special knowledge of counter-espionage legislation and preventive measures, some knowledge of law, legal procedure, and the laws of evidence. He should also know one or two languages thoroughly. So within this document, which is largely about what institutions can and should do, we have this early job description, which seems highly specific at first, or at least it's long, but on closer inspection, it's pretty vague. What is knowledge of men? What do they mean? Imagination? And what a moment to strike? The document also provides us with a nice segue into the intelligence concerns of the post-World War I years. Summarizing the intelligence operations of the war, this preface to the report, which again is from 1921, shifts focus from the dangers of German infiltration to that of communist infiltration. I'm quoting here. The German view was that the police could be molded to suit their ideas by threats and bribes. And this suspicion does not appear to be entirely unfounded. The war itself may partly have educated the public, but the lessons will soon be forgotten. It is impossible for the general public to have any idea of the extent of an enemy's espionage attack, and the majority are still found to discredit the allegations against the Bolsheviks. The best security of all might be a contented and well-informed general public. So contented and well-informed, it's worth asking ourselves how we might interpret this dictum for intelligence then and in our own period. Clearly, neither the public nor the intelligence community was particularly well-informed about certain aspects of operations during World War I, or else there would not have been such a mania for seeing spies everywhere. Contentedness also feels like a bit of a discordant metric, but it's curious to me that this is the word chosen. We have to keep the public contented, or else what? And in the context of communism, we'll get into this a lot more deeply in our next episode. This idea of a contented public in the early 1920s becomes a pretty serious one. But if we're going to talk about the history of recent intelligence services, we also have to talk about the ways in which intelligence agencies can, like Lecuze novels, spread uncertainty and misinformation and abuse the public trust. They are also almost always embedded with a deeply rooted fear of immigrant populations, as we can see in this case from the Alien Registry and from the service's use of xenophobic tropes about outsiders in place of real information. There's also a gendered dimension to the formation of MI5 and MI6. Tammy Proctor's book, Female Intelligence, Women and Espionage in the First World War, is a really great resource for this. Upon the passing of the Defense of the Realm Act in 1914, Britain needed manpower to enforce it. Defense of the Realm, or DORA, was pretty expansive. It regulated seemingly innocuous activities like flying kites and starting bonfires, and it also allowed the armed services to requisition private property and to, quote, otherwise prevent assistance being given to the enemy or the successful prosecution of the war being endangered. This is a pretty sweeping mandate. In practice, Proctor tells us, and this is a quote, port controls were transformed into interrogation centers, passports were issued for the first time after 1915, and civilians were limited in their access to coasts and military installations. DORA allowed the government to regulate the lives of its citizenry in unprecedented ways, ranging from shortened pub business hours to curfews for married women. And as part of the staffing of the major spy apparatus that the government undertook to build, quote, women were hired in large numbers to staff these organizations, and they proved essential to their successful operation, especially given the discrepancies between the size of the bureaucracy's tasks and the rudimentary technology they had available. So these women did thankless work, cheaply and secretly, for a government that did not even allow them the right to vote. In many ways, they constituted the backbone of the intelligence community. Cryptography is a really important part of the history of intelligence services, and it's going to keep appearing in the story of the Cambridge Five, because code breaking is ultimately what brought them down. By the end of 1914, cryptographers knew almost every move the Germans were going to make before they made it. Not only could they monitor German U-boats, they could pick up clues about the feelings of the United States, whom they hoped would enter the war. Now, this also presents a challenge, because if you get too good at decryption, someone on the other side is going to figure out that you have done the decrypting. And Room 40 also decrypted German diplomatic codes. The most famous example you've probably heard of, British code breakers decrypted the Zimmermann telegram, a coded message from German Foreign Minister Arthur Zimmermann to the German ambassador to the United States, which detailed a plan for luring Mexico to the war with the promise that Mexican territory in what was now Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona would be restored to Mexico at the war's conclusion. So Britain illicitly intercepted this message through US diplomatic channels and decoded it quickly so they knew what it said before its recipients. They then leveraged this information by leaking it to the US press, giving credit to the Secret Service for its interception to avoid embarrassing the US government. And this, combined with Germany's unconditional submarine warfare, which threatened both US naval and merchant interests, was enough to bring the United States into the war a month later. We know a little bit about what qualified a person to work in the cryptography department, and it wasn't brilliant mathematical skills. Christopher Andrew tells us that the British advised the Americans, when they formed their own cryptography department upon entering the war, to look for, quote, an active, well-trained, and scholarly mind, not mathematical, but classical. Sir Alfred Ewing, director of naval intelligence, stocked the department with academics. He brought on board a guy named Dilly Knox, a graduate of King's College, Cambridge, and himself from a prominent family. Dilly Knox liked to solve codes in the bath. There was a whole crew brought on who were fellows of King's College, Cambridge. There was also some classicism among the classicists. Andrew notes that Hall, quote, had a weakness for old Etonians, which is going to sound weird to a lot of American ears, or at least we like to pretend it sounds weird until you look around and see that we still totally do this. Basically, being given a job because of where you went to high school or college. It's worth pausing here to think about this formative moment for British intelligence services in the 20th century, when they were thinking about what kind of people should be working for them. And we should also think about our own popular ideas of what makes a spy. What are the qualifications? Women, of course, are not part of this imaginary perfect employee, even though women were a significant part of the intelligence services workforce. And within the British system of education in this period, there's no pathway for women to become a math genius from Eton who solve codes in the bath. It seems obvious, of course, but it's worth remembering. The cryptographers were also the weird new kids on the block. They were operating under the auspices of the Admiralty, and yet they were not Navy people. And we all know how institutions can react to the introduction of a new coterie of experts in their midst. So now you have these weirdos with their green ink and their bathtubs who say they're working with codes when no one's been working with codes for 70 years, and you're going to get some pushback. In our next episode, we'll be talking about UK-Russia relations in the post-World War I, post-Bolshevik Revolution period. Great Britain also faced major issues with keeping Russia in the war after Germany engineered Lenin's return. They provided him with a sealed train from Switzerland, and his arrival back in Russia was a big deal because it halted a potential cooperation between the Bolsheviks and the rival Mensheviks. As the Germans had hoped, Lenin called for Russia to dissolve the army and to pull out of the war. British intelligence tried to counteract this unsuccessfully. Russia's relationship with Great Britain also becomes quite complicated during World War I because they were ostensibly allies, and of course their royal families were closely related. But the Okhrana, the Tsarist secret service, had attempted to install spies in the British embassy at one point, and Russian intelligence agencies were so good at decryption that they were able to decrypt British telegrams very easily. It's not clear exactly how much they showed the Tsar, but some of these telegrams about the royal families, the Russian royal family's increasing unpopularity probably wouldn't have gone over that well. Just to wrap up, if you want to know about early modern spies, check out Stephen Alford's The Watchers, which is about spying during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. If you want to know about cryptography in the 17th century, which is so fascinating, Catherine Ellison Patterson, who is an English professor at Illinois State University, has done the best scholarship on this. Her recent book, A Cultural History of Early Modern Cryptography Manuals, is just now out in paperback. And she's also co-editor alongside Susan Kim, who is a fellow professor at Illinois State, of an edited collection called The Material History of Medieval and Early Modern Ciphers. She also has several articles published in academic journals on these topics, which you can access through JSTOR if your public library or university has JSTOR access. I was lucky enough to be on a panel with her at an academic conference a few years ago. She's a smart, smart lady. And if you're a student at Illinois State, go take a class with her. Since I'm being really meta about this, I should also tell you the podcast form is great, but it makes me nervous because I'm so aware of everything that I'm leaving out. It's really nice to have a through line, but if this podcast has any through line, it's going to be uneasiness with neatly encapsulated histories. So again, I pin that disclaimer to every episode. I also want to particularly thank Deborah Bauer, who's assistant professor in the Department of History at Purdue University in Fort Wayne. We were put in contact through a mutual friend, and she very generously shared her history of espionage syllabus with me. If you are a student at Purdue University Fort Wayne, you should really try and take this class because I really want to take this class. The syllabus just looks amazing. And as I said, she recommended Tammy Proctor's excellent book. She has a recent article called Planting the Espionage Tree, The French Military and the Professionalization of Intelligence at the End of the 19th Century, available in Intelligence and National Security, which is a journal. And you should absolutely check this out if you have that access, especially if you want to know more about the period right before the one we cover today. I'm really grateful that she took the time to correspond with me, and grateful that this podcast is giving me the opportunity to share knowledge and work through my own ideas. So if you're listening, you are a part of that. So thank you very much. Take care, and we will talk more next time.